morning. First case of the morning will be Gomez versus Berge. Ms. Renecki? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The Supreme Court in Ferretta said that to force a lawyer on a defendant can only lead him to believe that the law contrives against him. It did not say that if a defendant believes that the law contrives against him, then you can force a lawyer on him and call it manifest necessity for a mistrial. That is what happened in this particular case, and that is why Mr. Gomez's petition should be granted. Your Honor?
I was going to ask you, when he eventually pled like no contest or something here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that a conditional plea? Ordinarily a plea of guilty waives a lot of rights.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor, and the courts have found that. The Supreme Court precedent is clear on that. But the Supreme Court precedent is also clear that there's an exception. And when the court does not have the right to hail a defendant into court for a second time, a counseled plea of guilty cannot waive the right to any constitutional violations that preceded it.
So your petition is double jeopardy?
My petition is double jeopardy, right to self-representation.
And was that issue ever raised at the prior to entering that plea the second time around?
Which issue, Your Honor?
We're objecting to the court's granting a mistrial on its own motion and anything that happened in that first proceeding.
Absolutely. The defendant indicated on three separate occasions that he was ready, willing, and able to proceed. And that's the constitutional violation.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. When he goes in and pleads no contest, which is a guilty plea for all practical purposes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he, when he did that, say, I'm doing it conditionally, I want to retain all these issues from the first proceeding?
No, he did not, but the Supreme Court precedent doesn't require that he do so. He had made those objections on the record earlier, and the Supreme Court precedent in Brosi, which is a case that the Seventh Circuit had and the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed, a couple of the judges on this panel, in fact, were on that decision. The court said in that case there is a specific exception to the rule where the entrance of a guilty plea can waive the prior rights, and that is when you don't have the right to bring the defendant to court a second time. For instance, in Mena, a criminal defendant was convicted of a felony.
Pause just a minute. You have to raise the issue of double jeopardy yourself. Was that raised at the trial level?
The issue of double jeopardy was raised at the trial.
Where?
The issue of double jeopardy was raised in the context of the criminal defendant's requirement to continue to go forward.
No. Did somebody say you can't go ahead because I have already been put in jeopardy? Did anybody raise that issue so that the trial court was aware of the fact that double jeopardy was the beef before proceeding to the second phase?
I can't cite a particular instance in the record where the words double jeopardy were
raised. Was anything like double jeopardy ever? Anything even vaguely resembling double jeopardy? Right?
The record reflects that the standby counsel, the prosecutor, and the judge were all considering the aspect of double jeopardy and the implications of denying Mr. Gomez the right to continue to go forward. And I can give you those particular pages if you'd like.
I've read that portion of it.
But see, when he goes in the court the second, after everything has been, whether there's errors or not, the first proceeding, now he comes to the second proceeding, and there's essentially a contract reached, the concessions, charges dropped, and he enters a plea, and I didn't see anywhere in there where he said, I'm going through this deal, but I'm reserving my rights to challenge what happened early on.
I would say two things about that. One, neither Mena nor Brosi nor
I know your position is that that's not required.
And
my question is, was it done? And you say no.
I'm not sure that I can stand on the fact that it was not done for two reasons. First, because I think there was an absolute discussion of the consideration of a mistrial and a double jeopardy implication at the time that the mistrial was declared. And so I think that consideration was before the court. He was considering the implications at that time. Second, at the time the plea was entered, shortly thereafter, Mr. Gomez indicated that he rejected, that he wanted to waive his right to a plea, and he said that his plea at that time was tainted by the fact that he was not allowed to continue to proceed. In the instance case, the fact that he went forward and entered a plea of no contest cannot be determinative under the Mena, Brochi, and Blackledge authority. That authority says we're not going to look at anything other than does the state have a right to bring him in the room at that time and place charges against them. And if they didn't, then he's not going to waive any right by entering a plea of guilty. That plea of guilty has no legal effect. The right to representation in this case was his right to go forward with that jury. Under the double jeopardy standards, the court must consider in its exercise of discretion whether or not the defendant wants to go forward with that panel.
Well, that's not an absolute. If the defendant is obviously doesn't know what's going on and is goofing the whole thing up, do you think the judge just stands by and watch him make a farce of the whole thing, or can the judge finally intrude and say, listen, you're not able to handle this yourself?
The judge has two options. One, if the judge believes that he's truly not competent, that is
now,
not
mentally
competent.
I don't mean not competent in the insanity sense. I mean not competent to represent himself in this proceeding at all because he doesn't know what he's doing.
That is an improper consideration under Ferretta.
So no matter how bad a job the defendant is doing in terms of frustrating justice, the judge just stands by and watches it happen.
Ferretta only gives one example, and that is if there's obstructionist conduct. If the criminal defendant was obstructing the proceedings in some way, and if there was a finding that he was being obstructionist, then the court could rightfully withdraw his right to self-representation. But that's not the finding here. Instead, the court relied on the fact that he wasn't a very good lawyer.
No, he didn't.
He relied on that he just didn't have any understanding of what the system was and how things were working. He was digging a big hole for himself.
And if that's the case, he's in the majority. And that's what Ferretta says. Ferretta says, look, most criminal defendants aren't going to do a very good job, but the Constitution doesn't look at the law of averages. The Constitution says you have a right to represent yourself. And if you do it poorly, you have no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. You are
well,
allowed.
What if he wants to call 500 witnesses or something like that?
Then the judge has the absolute right to say that's too many, because that's what the judge says at the beginning of the proceeding, and that's what Ferretta says. Ferretta says the judge still has the right to implement its own court procedures. The judge can say to Mr. Gomez, just as it could have said to me if I was there representing him, that's enough. You get 10. Come back to me when you tell me which 10, and we're going to go forward. The judge has to control his own courtroom, and the Supreme Court gives him the right to do that. The Supreme Court says that there's no ineffective assistance of counsel. The Supreme Court says you have the right to implement your own court procedures. And at the time that Mr. Gomez knowingly and intentionally waived his right to represent himself, he was told in the hearing, you understand that the rules are going to apply to you just as they apply to everyone else. And we say that what the court should have done in this case is just simply applied his rules. But to take Mr. Gomez's right to self-representation away, and more importantly, to take away his right to go forward in front of that panel. Now, the court may have a different view of how Mr. Gomez proceeded, but Mr. Gomez knew that he stood in front of that court, and he was allowed to stand in front of the jury, give his opening statement, and tell his story. That's something many criminal defendants long for. He told them his story. He looked in their eyes. And having done so, he had the right to decide whether he should continue with that jury. And when the judge decided that it was for his own benefit that he'd not go forward with that jury, the judge violated his rights under double jeopardy, and it's contrary to the holding in Jorn, where the court says what you must consider is whether or not the defendant believes that he can continue in this case. It's just like the court's Seventh Circuit decision in Andrews. Some of the judges were also on that panel. Andrews is the flip side of that case. In Andrews, the court said, if you have the right to go forward, and you choose to go forward, even in front of a jury that's been biased against you, that's your choice, and we're going to hold you to it. Mr. Gomez wanted to make that choice, and the court wouldn't let him. That was a violation of his double jeopardy rights, and his petition should be granted.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Tripp?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd Tripp, and I represent the respondent in this habeas action. Because this case is here on collateral review, the question before the Court is whether the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision affirming Mr. Gomez's conviction was contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court. First, we reiterate our argument that Mr. Gomez waived his Sixth Amendment claim by pleading no contest to first-degree reckless homicide. In Siebold, this court concluded that a knowing and voluntary guilty plea waived the defendant's right to challenge a violation of his Sixth Amendment right to self-representation. Second, in Ferretta, the Supreme Court overruled a California court's holding that the right to self-representation is not constitutionally protected. On the contrary, the Supreme Court said, in addition to the right to counsel, the Sixth Amendment implicitly contains the right to represent oneself at trial. The Supreme Court held that under the circumstances present in Ferretta, the California court erred in forcing their competent defendant to accept counsel. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision is not contrary to Ferretta, nor is it an unreasonable application of Ferretta. The state court's decision implicitly recognizes Mr. Gomez's right to represent himself were he competent to do so.
I'm not much of a man for stickling things. We have a rule against reading to us.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm nervous.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll try not to look. I'm not really reading. I'm just kind of looking down.
Looked to me like you're reading, so...
Sorry. I apologize, Your Honor. On the face of the record before the Court of Appeals, the court acknowledged that the trial court's finding that Mr. Gomez demonstrated he was incompetent to exercise his right of self-representation was a reasonable finding, and there's nothing about that decision of the Court of Appeals that is antithetical to Ferretta. Finally, the Court of Appeals decision with regard to double jeopardy is not contrary to, nor is it an unreasonable application of Jorn or Arizona or any other Supreme Court case on double jeopardy. The trial
court. Do you agree with your opponent that there was an issue of double jeopardy raised at the trial level or not?
That's not my reading of the record.
So you don't think there was a...
I understand what I think she's saying about the discussion about the mistrial that was lengthy and that there seemed to maybe be some implicit acknowledgement about double jeopardy in that who called for the mistrial would implicate that right. But I don't see anything expressed in the record that Mr. Gomez raised a double jeopardy argument.
Well, if it's, I guess she's saying if it's an invalid declaration of a mistrial, that because the defendant didn't ask for it, therefore he's willing to stay in jeopardy and proceed, and he's had that taken away from him, I guess he says, therefore he was put in jeopardy twice. I guess that's his position.
Yeah, I guess I would just say that if there ever were a case of manifest necessity, this would be it. I mean, I think that the trial court was correct in declaring him incompetent to further represent himself, and then at that point it was manifestly necessary to start again.
Wasn't disrupting anything, was he?
No, but I think that he had demonstrated his incompetence.
Well, as your opponent pointed out, demonstrating your incompetence doesn't mean much. You've got a right to be. Everybody's got the right to rise the height of becoming a failure if he wants to.
But
I
think that Ferretta says that it's a right of a competent defendant to elect to represent himself.
Well, you have to be competent to represent yourself.
That's how I read Ferretta and Godinez and this court's decision in Brooks.
Specifically, what did they say that gives you that feeling that you have to demonstrate the guy is a competent lawyer?
I believe it's on page 835 of Ferretta. The court says, based on the facts that before it, that Ferretta was literate, competent, and understanding. And then the court goes on to say, under these circumstances, a defendant has a right to represent himself. So I would think that the converse would be true when those facts aren't before.
But there's nothing that says that you've read that says that if you're not erudite and knowledgeable, that you have lost your right to represent yourself?
No, and I don't think we're talking about erudition. I think it's just simple competence.
Yeah, but the definition of competence is very difficult to get to. And does the court have the right to stop anybody they think is proceeding incompetently and force an attorney upon them?
No, I think that the court here went through the classic factors and made a determination that he didn't warrant or he didn't merit counsel or he needed counsel. He was incompetent based on Klessig.
So it's the judge's determination that he needs counsel that is important.
I think so, yes.
Well, that would be true in almost every case. Could you think of a single judge that wouldn't think that you needed a lawyer if you were going to go to trial?
Oh, I think I don't have a case, but it does happen where people represent themselves.
Oh, yeah, that does happen.
Presumably the court thinks that they're confident.
We're talking about whether or not the judge can decide that I don't think you're able to take care of yourself, and I'm going to appoint somebody, and you're going to have to take them.
But I think that's why we have the classic inquiry. I think that
what's
it
the
is
classic inquiry?
The classic inquiry. Under classic, the four factors that the Wisconsin court set out to determine whether or not a defendant is knowingly or incompetently waiving counsel.
Let me get back to this guilty, no contest plea, guilty plea. Did the state argue in front of the magistrate judge or Judge Crabb that the guilty plea waived anything that occurred in the first trial?
In the district court, all that the respondent was...
Not in the district court. I'm talking about when...
Oh, I thought you said Judge...
I'm sorry. In the district court, when the petition for habeas relief is filed and the case was assigned to the magistrate, because I don't know that... There's nothing in Judge Crabb's decision relying on the magistrate's recommendation that discusses that issue, which seems to me to be an important one.
It was raised in our answer. We weren't required to brief it. Judge Crocker, the magistrate judge, determined or made his recommendation just based on the petition and the answer. And I think that in his decision, he said that he would have found waiver, but instead he was relying on Brooks. So,
well, see, there's a question of you can waive waiver.
Right.
The state didn't argue it.
It was set forth in the answer. I'm pretty sure. I didn't write that answer, but I'm pretty sure that Assistant Attorney General Ed Hughes did brief answer or raise waiver in his answer. Excuse me.
Okay.
Well, for those reasons, we ask that you affirm the district court's opinion. And that's, I guess, all that I have.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
You've got a little bit of time, not much. Just to finish up.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just on two issues that the court raised in their questioning. One, with respect to the waiver, there is no evidence that I was able to glean in the record that suggested that the argument that was made was that anything other than Siebold, the reliance on Siebold was the fact that the defendant in this case had pursued a right to self-representation and had a subsequent pleading of entry of guilty. But Siebold was different from the particular case because there were two separate proceedings. There was no consideration of the exception that's set forth in Mena, and by virtue of the fact that the court did not look at the proper rule, that's a further example that there was a violation of Mr. Gomez's rights in this particular case, and it was contrary to clearly established precedent.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume a defendant is charged with first-degree murder, and there's a mistrial declared, and pretty good argument you could make that the mistrial was caused by prosecutorial misconduct, which would bar a second trial, if that is, in fact, the case. So instead of going ahead with the second trial, the defense and the prosecution get together, and a deal is struck, and a plea of guilty is entered to homicide by reckless conduct, a lesser included offense. And no mention is made when the defendant pleads guilty to that charge of a reserving any type of double jeopardy argument on appeal. Is it your position that that's not necessary?
Absolutely, because the court has no right to enter that verdict. The court has no right to enter a guilty plea and a verdict of guilt because jeopardy has already attached in the first proceeding, and that would be entry in a second proceeding violating the rights of double jeopardy.
Okay.
Were you appointed in this case?
Yes, I was, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. It doesn't indicate that on here. We appreciate your accepting in the assignment.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Tom Schreiner was appointed, and we're appearing with him. Also, Olya Peshakova, I should acknowledge her, who was very helpful on the briefs.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This case will be taken under advisement. Move to the second case of the morning, which is Rajo versus